The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Yesterday, following DNA tests, Israel confirmed the death of Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, a key figure in orchestrating the October the 7th attack that led to the current war in Gaza. Now, whether the killing of the 61-year-old Khan Yunis native will be an opportunity to end the conflict quickly, or whether it will provide an incentive for the war on Gaza to continue, it's still unclear because no one knows what Israel's plan is for the day after the fighting ends. Joining me now to talk about all of this is David Dunn, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. David, good morning.
Good morning.
I was watching Netanyahu making his speech live to his country, announcing the death of Yahya Sinwar, the confirmation of his death. And he said, you know, they've settled their account with Yahya Sinwar by killing him and their account with Hamas. And yet he pledged to continue the war. So what's going on?
Well, there's an opportunity here for both Hamas and Israel to take this death as a stopping point in the conflict. And yet it seems as if Netanyahu is reluctant to actually embrace that opportunity. That's certainly what the Biden administration wants. It's certainly what Kamala Harris wants. But he instead looks set to actually pocket this victory as he sees it and to prosecute further, because Israel has not secured Gaza. They have targeted and killed lots of Hamas fighters, but they haven't got control of that territory. And similarly, in the north, there's unfinished business there as far as they're concerned in trying to actually destroy the capability of Hezbollah to fire rockets into northern Israel. So while the world will be watching and hoping and arguing for this opportunity to be embraced, it seems as if the Israelis, for one, certainly from what they've said so far, are not willing to actually do that.
Now, Yahya Sinwar is credited as being, if you like, the ideologue in Hamas, but I'm sure there are many around him who believe the same as he did, which was that October the 7th, so extraordinary was the nature of that atrocity that it would create a regional conflict. What is the likelihood that someone will come to the top of Hamas who might have a different view?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to recognize just that Sinwar was somebody who deliberately sacrificed Gaza's security, knowing that the attack on October the 7th would come with some sort of response on this scale. And that view is shared by the leadership within Hamas. I mean, they are implacably opposed to the existence of Israel. They are wanting the establishment of an Islamist state in Palestine. And they have been blocking any attempt to do a deal with Israel that doesn't leave Hamas in control of the Gaza Strip. And the question is, as you say, will his brother take over and keep those views going, or will a more moderate person, perhaps in the Hamas organization based in Qatar, be the replacement, and therefore we get a change in position from the leadership going forward? Because, you know, that is a crucial aspect of this equation, because in a sense you've got two obstacles to progress on this. You've got Israel and you've got Hamas, both being opposed to any sort of closing the gap on what could be done there. And if you get progress on the Hamas side, then there's at least the possibility that you can get progress on the Israeli side. So who they choose next is crucial. If it's Mohammed Sinwar who takes over, then it's the same situation as before. If we get a change in position or a change of leadership, then there's the opportunity for progress to be made.
The problem is, whichever course they take, there is a massive rebuilding to be done in Gaza. I mean, that little strip of land has been pretty much destroyed by the Israelis.
Yeah, and there's opportunities there, because what I mean, on the right of the Israeli debate, they want that land for themselves and to rebuild it and occupy that. But most people say, and there is almost a framework agreement already agreed between America and the Arab League and Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And the framework's actually important for the future of Gaza. The framework is that Israel makes peace with Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Arab world in return for Saudi Arabia taking the leading role in rebuilding Gaza, paying for that, making that happen, and making the political governance of Gaza one which isn't a threat to Israel. So that's the broad framework, and that therefore, in a sense, the opportunity and the need to rebuild Gaza is part of that, because Israel doesn't want the smoking ruin of Gaza on its border either, by and large, because it needs to have a functioning territory there that is governed in a way that actually works, is democratic, is representative, and isn't a threat to Israel. So it's just getting from where we are now to that end point.
But even if they reach that end point where you have some sort of government over Gaza, which is not Hamas, which is supported by the international community, it would not stop a rump of Hamas ideologues having a go at that government, creating, if you like, a civil war, maybe some sort of guerrilla war within a rebuilding Gaza.
And that is a possibility, and that's why what they're talking about is having international peacekeepers in there, including peacekeepers from the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, but also international peacekeepers trained by America and Jordan. The camp's already there waiting to train these peacekeepers to actually create a governing structure that prevents Hamas being resurgent and coming back and being a threat to Israel in a way that actually perpetuates this crisis.
Now, what Netanyahu has demonstrated, or he's trying to demonstrate to his own cabinet, who are pushing him, and to his own people, force works. The military strategy is better than diplomacy. Look what we've done.
And certainly, Netanyahu would argue up to this point that strategy seems to have been winning. They have effectively destroyed Hamas as a functioning organization. They have taken the fight to Hezbollah in a way to try and get their security, in a way in which security wasn't being provided by the situation in Lebanon before that. And they have also, it would seem, in that part, from that perspective, cowed Iran to a degree. So there is a degree to which he is saying, look at me, I am building success for you. The trouble is that only goes so far. That gets you tactical victories. It does not get you a strategic victory. It doesn't get you security in the long term. But it seems as if Netanyahu is going from the short term to the short term without a clear idea of what his long term is, without his clear idea of what his strategic vision is for the future. And that's what the Americans and others are trying to actually get him to move beyond the short term to the long term, because in the short term you can't keep fighting on this scale at this pace with these losses. And I think Israel realizes that. It's just to see how we get from this point to that point.
Yeah, but he knows that his own position would be under threat as soon as the war stops. He's no longer a wartime PM. He is a politician facing corruption charges.
Yeah, and this is the extraordinary aspect of how the personal and the political intertwine, because just now he has a coalition that keeps him in power that is implacably opposed to anybody doing any concession for any sort of governance or territory for the Palestinians. So in the short term, that's the case. And to break away from that in order to move towards peace would either require him to try and form a new coalition, which is uncertain, or to give up power. And that, of course, means that A, he's not in power, and B, he is then liable for the corruption charges that are waiting for him once he's no longer in office. So there is that complication of Netanyahu's personal situation playing into the wider politics.
Now, talk to me about the United States and its continued military support with the threat. If you don't get a lot of humanitarian aid into Gaza and do it quickly and do a lot of it, military funding may be under threat. So in terms of who might be president post November the 5th, Netanyahu will possibly be calculating his actions, maybe even to influence the American election.
Yeah, there's several aspects of this. I mean, the the ultimatum given by the Americans, really interesting, 30 days, so after the election. So actually there's no decision point required on the Biden administration before the election takes place. But it's both a signal of the frustration the Americans have with Netanyahu on the one hand, but also an attempt to try and help Harris to win the election by showing that the Democrats can be tougher on Israel than they have been up to this point. There's a huge frustration and a worry that actually Netanyahu will do something, perhaps by retaliating against Iran in the next 2 weeks, that will make the situation worse for the Democrats and therefore help Donald Trump to win, because Netanyahu calculates that Trump will be a much more sympathetic leader in the White House to Netanyahu's approach than has been the case even under the Biden administration. That the speculation that if Netanyahu's endgame really is to actually try and preemptively destroy Iran's nuclear capabilities, then Trump would be much more supportive of that than was the case with the Biden administration. And it's interesting the way that plays, because Donald Trump's often portrayed as an isolationist, but he's an isolationist only as far as it goes in terms of actually reducing threats to America directly. The America First aspect of that is, let's stop Iran getting the bomb, let's stop North Korea getting the bomb before they can fire that at us. So actually, on those issues, he's quite hawkish. So the politics, the electoral politics of this are also in play. And it's really interesting to see Harris's statement last night. You know, she was calling much more strongly than she has done before for an end to the war, let's declare this the day after, and actually much more critical in her tone and her language and the content in terms of actually calling for an end to this conflict. Her frustration is clear, because she could lose by the defection of Arab and Muslim voters in the Midwest and not supporting her, and her losing the election as a consequence of this war.
But they won't vote for Trump, presumably, if he is even more pro-Netanyahu than a Biden administration and possibly a Harris administration might be.
Well, only if electoral politics were so rational as you suggest. Unfortunately, what you have is a lot of young voters and a lot of Arab voters who are saying that actually we're not going to vote for anybody. And that's effectively voting for Trump. And that's what we'll end up with. And so the frustration of the Democratic Party is saying, you may not like us, but we're better than the alternative. And they're taking an absolutist rather than a relative position on this and saying, you're behaving in this way and therefore we're not supporting you. And that's the problem that Harris has.
David Dunn, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.